So, you want to be a contractor. Ever wonder what it takes to become a contractor? The journey they go on to get where they are now, or the crazy things they see and hear on the job site? Well, you're in the right spot. Welcome to So You Want to Be a Contractor, the podcast. Join your host, Mike Fisher, as he talks to owners of construction companies from all over about how they got started, how they run their business, and some of the craziest stories they've experienced on their job sites. And now, your host, Mike Fisher.
Welcome to So You Want to Be a Contractor. This is episode number 37. My name is Mike Fisher, and my co-host over there, Maricela Arechiga. How are you?
I am doing great, Mike. And you are getting so good at saying my name. It's just like you were born to say it.
That just rolled right off the tongue, huh? It just
rolled right off the tongue. We have entered a new level of our relationships. It is a new week. I am feeling energized and excited. And just by like getting into the introduction, Mike, with who Kevin is, I'm pumped. I can't wait to hear this story. This is going to be good.
We've had a couple weeks off, so this is going to be fun.
Yeah, buckle up because I have a good feeling about Kevin. Kevin, I have a good feeling about you.
So our guest today on that, Kevin Booth, CEO of Westport Companies out of Las Vegas, Nevada. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm fantastic. How are you guys?
We're doing great.
Thanks for taking some time here with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Glad to be here.
So Maricela hinted at it a little bit, but before we get to where you are now, and I'm sure she's going to interrupt you a number of times on that journey because she's good at
that's my job.
That's your role. She's here for.
That
let's,
is my job.
Let's go back to the beginning. How did you get into this industry? How did you get to where you are now? We want to know what that journey looked like.
What do you do, first of all? Like, what do you do?
So Westport Companies is a group of specialty trade contractors. So our main trades are framing and concrete. We also have another division that does material placement. We have telebelts that do concrete, type 2 gravel, et cetera, material placement. Okay. But framing is the bread and butter of our operation. That's what we started in 1989 with our framing company.
Okay.
And so in 2022, whatever now, almost 2023, where stick framing seems to be going out the window, how have you, well, I feel like that's a question for later down the road, but
good.
I know. I'm sorry.
You were going all the way down the road. I want to know what you're.
It just
what
blows
you do.
My mind. Well, yeah, it just blows my mind that you're at that volume, doing stick framing. When
don't give it
more
away,
more
Mike. We haven't given numbers away yet, dude. Kevin, so we're at the beginning.
Go back to the beginning then.
Yeah. So you told us what you do.
Yeah.
Tell us your origin story.
Sure. Yeah. The origin story. I mean, for me personally, I spent the first 10 years of my career in the hospitality industry here in Las Vegas, which is kind of it's a company town, if you will. I mean, hospitality is what we do. It's restaurants, bars, nightclubs. So I did that the first 10 years.
Preach, man. I was in restaurant management for 10 years.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, but Kevin, Mike says that everyone should work in the hospitality industry at some point.
Oh, yeah. It's a great school.
It's a great school.
Yes, you learn a lot there for sure. And so Westar Development entered into the hospitality industry, and that's how I joined Westar Development and worked in their hospitality division. They had opened a La Salsa restaurant at Caesars, the Forum Shops at Caesars, when Caesars first opened the Forum Shops. We were one of the initial restaurants there. And so I was in the hospitality division at Westar Development. And then Westar got into the framing business. They were building multifamily projects, and there was a labor shortage of framers. And Jim Hammer and Pam Hammer were the partners of Westar Development. And they thought, well, maybe if we created our own framing company, those framers would show up at our jobs first before working on other jobs. Mm-hmm. And then so they met Michael Coronado, who at that time was with Knipp Brothers Framing. And they teamed up and formed Westcor, which is the combination of Westar and Coronado, and created Westcor Construction in 1989. And we began doing residential and multifamily framing back then. We started initially with 40 employees. I think we had 4 pickup trucks, we grew considerably over the years, into the early 2000s. By 2003, we decided to get into the concrete business because stick framing, as you know, is attached to a foundation, and there are always issues with embeds and making sure that the layout is done properly. And so we thought if we did our own slabs, our own foundations, we could solve some of those problems for our customers and work together internally.
That process for sure.
Yeah. So the vertical integration there and take that off our customers' hands. So that's how we got into the concrete business. So we created Coronado Concrete in 2003. And then we continued growing. We expanded areas from here in Las Vegas. We expanded into Arizona and Southern California, Utah, by the time we got to 2006, 2007, we had nearly 2,000 employees in four states.
What?
Yes. It was.
What? Does that even look like? How do you have
2,000 employees? Yes. It was out of control. That's what it was. It was out of control.
Okay. Yeah. So you go to 2,000, you start at 40 employees, you go all the way up to, you open up some different arms of the business. It increases your overhead to 2,000 employees.
2,000, yes.
How many of those 2,000 were people in the field doing the work? Like, what was the breakdown of that? How many?
I would say roughly 1,900. So we might have had 100 administrative positions and management positions. So about 1,900 of them would have been field personnel.
Yeah. Goodness. Okay.
Yes. Then the recession hits. and I should back up and clarify for everyone that we primarily work in residential multifamily, which I mentioned. So that was the bulk of our business. And so when the Great Recession hit, that segment got hit harder than any other segment in construction.
Yeah, it did.
The residential. Not only was residential hit hard, but the market areas we were in, we're talking, Phoenix and Southern California and Southern Nevada, Las Vegas. We hit the trifecta in Utah, the trifecta of, just implosion of residential.
Okay.
I mean, the only thing that could have been worse is if we were in Florida, maybe. Florida got hit hard too. We dodged that bullet, I guess.
But on that account, they also are the fastest to rebound though too, right?
Right. Exactly. Opinion. Exactly. Yeah. That's
Southern
a very
California's
good,
as well.
Yeah. Very good point. Yeah. So we are faster to rebound and we have good fundamentals. I mean, people still want to live here in the Sun Belt or in the Southwest United States here. We used to have a director of finance here. I remember he would always come in and celebrate whenever the news reported a blizzard hit in the Northeast, because he knew that meant more people were going to be moving here. So he would go around the office high-fiving people because we had a blizzard in the Northeast.
Of that happening right now. Ian just did what it did to Florida. Kevin, let me ask this. So you, before the Great Recession, you have 2,000 employees. Recession hits. First question, who are your clients? Who are the people that you go out to bid for?
And that's interesting because it's different now than it was before the recession. Before the recession, there were a lot more private home builders, but a lot of them disappeared during the recession. Now, most of our customers are publicly traded home builders. So they're the larger companies. They're the Lennar, KB, D.R. Horton, Toll Brothers, and other companies like that you're familiar with. That are national builders. Those are our primary customers today. But before the recession, there were a lot more smaller regional builders that we worked with.
Okay. So I don't know how many businesses or, contractors or people in our trades that have an entity like yours. But one of the things I want to pull out here is what you learned in that recession, what your outfit looked like before and how you recovered, because economies of scale are changing. We're in that place again. And I think everybody, if they're thinking about their business appropriately, needs to be thinking about how to live through what's coming and then what it might need to look like, what it did look like for you.
Absolutely.
After.
Absolutely. Yeah. We learned a lot of lessons during that time. I remember, and I should clarify too, at that time I was CFO of the organization and Michael Coronado was CEO. And I remember early on in the recession, Mike coming into my office and sitting down, and he had a worried look on his face, which is unusual because Mike was always a very confident individual. And he sat down, crossed his arms, and sat across from my desk and said, "So, are we going to be all right?" And I said, well, I think we're going to be all right. But my main concern is that one by one, our customers are going out of business.
Yeah.
These private home builders that I was talking about, one by one, they were closing their doors. And I don't care how good you are. If you don't have customers, then what are you going to do then? Because as a specialty trade contractor, we don't build our product. We build other people's product.
Yes.
Right.
So I need a customer to bring me a project to build for them.
Yes.
When you start losing them, you begin to get concerned. But beyond that, some of the things that we did, we decided to diversify. We moved into other areas of construction beyond residential. We picked up a lot more commercial work. And that certainly helped because there was a delayed reaction in the economy at that time. Residential got hit first, but commercial, industrial type product, stayed fairly healthy for a little while. So we were able to pivot and take on more of that work. And that,
so
that
Kevin, you diversified, you went more commercial. Did you diversify your customer?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So we started going for those commercial general contractors that we weren't working with before instead of those private home builders instead. So yeah, we definitely picked up a new customer base and that helped a lot. Now I know other contractors at that time diversified regionally as well. They went into new markets looking for work. While I contemplated that, ultimately we decided to do the opposite and we decided to contract instead. The first opportunity being, I know our corporate office that we had in the Phoenix area, our lease was up, and I said, this is the proverbial fork in the road here. We can sign a new lease and double down, or we can end it right here. And so we decided to close that operation down. So we pulled out of Arizona initially, and then a few years later, we wound down our California operations as well. And Utah and decided to contract and just focus on Las Vegas. And so earlier I mentioned we had 2,000 employees.
That more because the business was there in Vegas versus Phoenix or California? Or was that a conscious decision to be able to keep your hands on and control a lot of that stuff while the margins were probably pretty tight?
Yeah. There wasn't really any more work here in Las Vegas than there was in Phoenix or Southern California. But it was just like you said, just the strategy to get smaller, to get a better handle on things. So I mentioned earlier the 2,000 employees being out of control, and it really was out of control. So our strategy was to be smaller and better. So we contracted, we rolled up those operations. As tough as it was we put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into moving into those other market areas. And so it's really tough to retreat like that. It was a tough decision to make, but we knew it was the right decision. And so we contracted.
The right decision was to be smaller and better.
Smaller and better, exactly. We had a better saying. Our slogan was, we'd rather work less and make more.
Yeah. So we're talking margins.
Right.
Margins, people.
So, yes, exactly. So well, let's get smaller and let's just be selective about the work we take and make sure it's the high profit work. High GP work was our goal. And so
what did the numbers look like?
At our low point there, we ended up down to 220 employees at our low point. From 2000, so nearly 90% reduction in staff. So it was really a tough one for us.
Yeah.
But it worked. I mean, we were able to survive where others couldn't. We essentially looked and threw anything that wasn't nailed down overboard to stay afloat. So we scaled back our market area. We scaled back departments. We consolidated departments. We consolidated offices. We just here in Las Vegas had four separate office buildings in the complex here, the area that we're at, and we were able to shed ourselves of three of those buildings and got down to one. We also have a real estate division, Mountain West Group, that handles all of our real estate, and so we. I like to say we got really good at buying high and selling low because we paid top dollar for the buildings that we were in and sold them during the recession to retract. So anybody wants some advice on how to do that, I'm really good at that.
No, don't do it. Did you go in, we're talking about the recession still, in the diversification that you had, did you do any public work?
We did a little bit of public work. And I'll tell you why we didn't do more of it is the nature of our business. That's something else that, that shifted during those years. So I mentioned we started in 1989 with our framing company. And at that time, we were one of only two hourly framing companies here in Las Vegas, meaning where our carpenters worked on an hourly rate. Most framers work on a piece rate basis.
Piece rate, yeah.
And as we got into the early 2000s and started getting busier and busier, we were unable to find any carpenters willing to work for an hourly rate. And so we had to start bringing on piece rate crews. And actually, at one point, we created a whole separate company called Coronado Framing, separate from Westcor, just for piece rate carpentry. And ultimately decided to roll that back up into the main Westcor company. So as we got, by the time we got to the recession, hourly employees were almost non-existent at that point. It was all piece rate. So going into the recession now, most of our carpenters are piece rate, and trying to do public work where you've got prevailing wage rates that are based on an hourly rate, and trying to do that with piece rate workers was really difficult to do. We really struggled with that.
Even for a seasoned CFO, that those numbers and math were tough, huh?
Oh yeah. That's
a lot of, for sure. Yeah. That's a lot of,
it was tough to do. It was tracking. Tough to get to. Yeah, it was. It was difficult to do, to make that conversion. And mostly for the employees. The employees, you know, they really prefer the piece rate. Now I will say as CFO at the time and now as CEO, I would much rather pay hourly. I have much more control and compliance, you know, compliance is difficult with piece rate, but I understand where the employees are coming from. They, you know, they earn a lot more, on a piece rate basis.
Yeah. Kevin, here's some things that I am taking away and I'm highlighting as, again, and I think this is an important pause in your story, because economies are shifting and we're moving. Things are moving in a different direction than what we've been in for the last 10 years. But the first thing that changed for you as you went into recession was your philosophy. Mm-hmm. The second thing that changed was instead of going out, you contracted.
Yes.
Right. And in a very serious way. And the third thing is that you diversified. Mm-hmm. Do you see was that a map you created for yourself, or was this, we have to survive any means necessary, and we're going to figure this out as we go?
Yeah, I would like to say that I'm a genius and had this all planned out.
No one knows. You could.
The recession was difficult to navigate because nobody knew how long it was going to last. I mean, we're talking 6 months, a year, 6 years. And it just dragged on and on and on. So it was really difficult to navigate. I like to equate it to trying to catch a falling knife. Trying to make a decision of what to do next.
You're gonna get hurt.
Yes, exactly. And it's just, you're just kind of frozen and trying to make a decision. In hindsight, we made some really good decisions. Mike Coronado and I met on a regular basis and we weighed our various options. One of those options obviously was, we could have bankrupted the company and just started over again from scratch, which I know a lot of people did that. And to Mike Coronado's credit, his name was worth more than that and the reputation of the company, and he was not going to do that. We were going to survive one way or another, and bankruptcy was not an option. So that helped, knowing that bankruptcy was not an option. If that's not an option, then this is what we got to do. We charted that path to get there. To borrow a Vegas slogan, we could have doubled down by expanding into other areas. Instead, we decided to take some chips off the table, if you will, and play it safe rather than risk more.
Yeah.
And the same strategy paid off for us.
Obviously made more good decisions than bad through that process, right? But from a learning standpoint, and if we're using this podcast as a resource, were there some bad decisions that were made that you look back and go, man, we probably shouldn't have made that one?
Most of the bad decisions were probably made before the recession. One of those bad decisions being we did have a lot of debt. We had a lot of debt going into the recession. We expanded into multiple areas. I talked about we had 2,000 employees, and we probably had 20 companies under our umbrella at that time. A lot of development. We were into real estate development. We moved into Idaho. We were doing real estate development out there. We had a ranch in Oklahoma. And so there were a lot of areas that we were in, and to expand into those markets, we typically brought on debt with it, especially with the real estate development. We had real estate, construction loans, out there on various projects. And so, you know, when the recession hit, it's a little bit like musical chairs, you know, suddenly the music stopped and we were looking for a chair to sit on. And when you've got a lot of debt, you don't have a chair to sit on when you're saddled with that debt.
Yeah, the bank walks you in. The bank's like, I got your chair right over here, mister. Thank you very much. We've been looking for you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I remember one of our local banks here had called me into a meeting and to let me know that our loans or assets with them were being placed into their special assets division.
Probably not a good kind of special, huh?
Yeah, exactly. That was my point, because I relayed that information to Mike Coronado, our CEO, our founder and CEO, and said, you know, we're in special assets now. And he goes, that sounds like a good thing, but somehow I think it's not. I said, no, we're not special in a good way. He said, why? And I said, because we're a contractor. And so that's what banks were doing. Anybody that was in construction was just automatically placed into special assets because you are a high risk customer.
High risk,
automatically. Yeah, it doesn't matter. But we never missed a payment. It doesn't matter if you ever missed a payment. It's the industry that we're in.
Yeah.
So
Kevin, you learned a lot. A lot of your mistakes were made before the recession.
Yes.
You go into recession. The name means more than getting out of it. So you keep the company, you downsize. We have been in the last 10 years in construction in some of the most incredible climate economically,
yes.
Right? Like
yes.
There's so much opportunity. How right. did you make sure, how did you waver from, or did you waver from learning from the sins of the past into where we've been in the last, I'd say it's solid 6 years.
Yeah.
So that you don't make those mistakes again, or did it matter?
Well, we didn't. We tried real hard to remember what we learned. Our director of finance, I mentioned earlier, Feliciano Sanchez, I remember him saying that, you know, that we've learned a lot of lessons, but we also have short memories. And when the good times roll, we tend to forget those lessons learned during the bad times. But we tried real hard to remember them. We currently are at 450 employees.
Oh,
we avoided going back to where we were. We could have easily grown back to 2,000 employees if we wanted to. We could have gone back into those markets. And you
why
know,
didn't
into,
you? And,
because of the lessons learned. You know, we thought, you know, let's not do that again. We did that. You know, we saw that movie. We did. I don't right. like how it ended. So let's.
Yeah, 2,000 people is a lot of people to manage. That's in construction, man. Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And Mike Coronado and I sat down one day and we just picked an arbitrary number at one point, and probably in that back when we only had a couple hundred employees or so, and we decided we never want to have more than 500 employees, and it was just an arbitrary number, but we are bumping close to it at 450. Mm-hmm. But that was a number we decided. We decided we would rather be a smaller contractor, but be better. We treat our employees better. We have the highest quality staff. We do quality work. You know, we do work more safely. And we're more reliable. You know, when we tell our customer, you know, this is the schedule, we're going to follow that schedule. But when you get too big, it's tough to do those things. It's tough to be safe. It's tough to be reliable and on time. It gets out of control.
Yeah. Again, Kevin,
I'd rather be in control.
Let's get into that now. Let's get into the business that you have right now and talk to us a little bit about how you organize it, because still like close to 500 employees in construction, that's a lot. So how do you stay high level? How do you keep your margin? How do you manage 500 people? And I'm going to pretend that there's 380 of those people in the field.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deliver on that?
Yeah. Good quality people to start with. So
where do you get them? How do you do that?
I was going to say,
we're going to stay there for an hour.
More than how do you manage them is how do you get them, right? I mean, everybody's talking about labor shortages and everything else, and you're over here hoarding 450 employees.
Right. And hoarding is a good word. We are hoarding, yes. We are hoarding.
Which, I mean, yeah, there's no negative connotation to that at all, right?
No.
You got to do what you got to do to keep them,
right.
But more importantly, how do you even find them? Yeah. How do you develop them?
You know what?
Find
we
them and keep them.
You know what? The funny thing is we don't find them. They find us. And I think that's where being a quality company, we treat our employees well. We have great benefits. People like to work for us. And I think that's the key. If we're good, they're going to come to us. And we filter through it. Not to say that, you know, we don't get some bad crews here and there, and we do once in a while. But you know, as they say, cream rises to the top, and so the best crews rise, and so we keep the best, and the marginal crews we don't, and the rest of our staff appreciate that. They know that, you know, their coworkers are the best as well. And so I think just being a good company is what's helped us a lot. And I hear that from employees all the time that say, man, there's nobody else we would rather work for than Westcord. I don't mean to pat myself on the back here.
You should. But, you should pat yourself on the back.
Yeah, be proud of it.
Mike, that's not the first time we've heard that from other people. Like, we don't go looking. They come to us because we really...
And on that philosophy of like that cream rising to the top, like something that I learned in restaurant management and in that hospitality industry was, especially when, I mean, if you're comparing the mindset of the employee, right? A server or a bartender in a restaurant is kind of a little bit like a construction worker in the field, right? Where they're kind of in and out, right? Kind of always looking for something better and maybe unless you treat them right or whatever else, but we were always taught in restaurant management to always be looking to replace your bottom 5%.
Right.
Doesn't matter how good you think your staff is. Mm-hmm. If you rank them, you've got a bottom 5%, and you should always be looking to hire or develop somebody to replace that bottom 5%. And that mentality goes a long way from not only from a quality of your staff standpoint, but that motivates your staff, right? Especially if they know that we're all, you know, we're not going to tell you what these rankings are, but just know that we're always looking to replace our bottom 5%. So if you get down there, if you probably know that you're down there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then also for the people that are always at the top, they know that they're always working with quality people, right? They don't have to be dragging those people from the bottom because that bottom is always getting better and better and better. And I think that mentality, that philosophy goes a long way, especially when you've got that many people.
Yeah, absolutely does.
You're always hiring. That's a really great point. Is that the people coming to you, but that doesn't mean that you stop hiring. When that good person shows up and says, "I'm interested," you don't say no.
Right.
You don't say no.
Yeah. We are always hiring. You can check our website. You'll see that we are always hiring because you're always looking for better. And we keep the best.
Talk about some of the things you do to keep them. I mean, I can't imagine it's just. Mm-hmm. Hey, we give them work and we pat them on the back and we're nice to them, right? I mean, there's got to be some things from a benefits, not only from, you know, the typical definition by, you know, medical and dental and all those things, but are there other things you guys do from a team building or morale or those kind of standpoints that kind of help drive retention?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we try to connect, you know, the field to our office. That's always there's always a big gap between the office and field in most companies. So we send our office staff out to the field periodically to visit job sites, and then we'll bring food trucks out, and then we'll bring some raffle items, and we'll have the staff kind of, you know, walk the job site, the office staff meaning walk the job sites with field crews, so they get an opportunity to show off their handiwork, and the crews love to show off. Here, this is what we do,
humanizing those guys that are out there doing that work.
Yeah. So good.
Exactly. So that helps a lot. So it connects those two groups of our staff, our office staff with our field staff. And it's a win-win. So like I said, the field personnel, they get, you know, a nice lunch, and there's some raffle prizes that we give away, but they get to show off their handiwork and what they do. And they're really proud of that. And then our office staff, they get to learn more about, you know, terminology and things that we talk about here in the office that they don't see physically, being on the side, and they can appreciate more, the work that's actually done out in the field. So it's a win-win for both. And so, we found that to be, a really effective tool that we use, for employees. But I think overall, it's just our culture, is probably the number one thing. It's not benefits. It's not paying more. It's not having, you know, and we have all that. We have good pay. We have good benefits, but it's just a good culture of, trust. We're all coworkers here. I really don't like org charts that much, even though they are necessary. We're all coworkers. And so when I'm out in the field, I'm out there just hanging out with my coworkers, same with the staff. And just having a good, honest culture where you know, you can trust, staff could trust me, I can trust them. There's not a lot of negativity, not too much pressure. Everybody just gets along and has a good time.
Yeah. There's two things that culture doesn't really cost a lot.
No.
You know, benefits cost. You have to have the right margins so that you have the right benefits that helps retain. But culture doesn't cost much. And you know, Mike and I, this is also a pattern that we're hearing with very successful companies, is that they create culture. And I think that's one of the things that in the construction industry, we miss. Like we are, for if you're a small company, if you're a big company, we still have the responsibility as the owners and the leaders of the business to create and cultivate culture. Sure. It doesn't cost a lot. It doesn't cost a lot to do that.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't. And it goes back to, you know, what Mike was saying earlier about that 5%. You know, we're always trying to find people that's, you know, most important quality is people that will fit into our culture, that appreciate it and want to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately, when you get down to the basics of human nature, we all just want to belong, right?
We all just want to be a part of
something. We want to belong to something, a group, a tribe. And so this is the West Core tribe, and everybody's welcome here, and we're family.
Kevin, do you come from a construction background?
No, I don't. So I have a finance background. So as I mentioned earlier, I was a CFO. But I will say, you know, right out of high school, I did major in architecture at Texas Tech University. So I got the architecture background, but then I switched majors to computer science and then ultimately to accounting. So I got computer science, architecture, and accounting in my education. But
wide variety of education there,
Yes.
But you come from a business background, right? Like that is your background. And you're looking at the construction industry through that lens. What do you think our industry needs the most so that we are thinking more high level than we are operating on? So that these reputations that we have start to become a thing of the past? Because in our industry, there's still a lot of ways we feel like we're in the Wild West. Mm-hmm. We're ancient in some of the operations that we do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the thing we have to realize is that we're in the service industry. Kind of like Mike said earlier, that's a lot. I mentioned my first 10 years was in the hospitality industry, which ultimately is the ultimate in service. And I think most people readily recognize that anybody in hospitality, and if you're a server at a restaurant, if you're a bartender, there's no doubt about it, you're in the service industry, right? You deal with customers. But I think people forget that construction is a service industry.
Yeah.
You know, we provide a service and we are, especially as a specialty trade, you know, maybe not as a general contractor, even as a general contractor, though, you're providing a service there too. But from our perspective as a specialty trade contractor, we are labor intensive. So, you know, our people are, that's our product.
Yeah.
it's our people.
Our people are the product.
Yes, it is the service that we provide. And so we've got to invest in good people, because it takes good people to provide that service, to provide that quality, the safety, the reliability that we try to give to our customers. We got to have good people. We just got to remember we're in the service industry providing a service.
So am I hearing then that if you want to be able to offer a good product, a good service, it's time for small mom and pops and big outfits, 2,400 people, that we're really taking care and investing in our product, which is our people. We're not buying wood here. We don't buy people. But if we don't have the people to swing the hammer, and we're not treating them right, then we're not offering a good service, a good product.
Yes, exactly.
Because it is trends. Here's what I know about what we do. We're in a transformational business. We transform people's lives, right? Whether you're a general contractor just in home renovation, or you're building these big multifamily units, it's transformational. So it's not transactional in the way that the restaurant business is. You give me food and I pay you money and I
There are sometimes food changes my life. I don't know what you're talking about. Especially or a beer. There's sometimes a beer changes my life and my wife appreciates that. But
you haven't been to the right restaurant yet, Marcella. Listen, transform you.
there's a taco stand right around the corner. It changes my life every time I
there you go.
It changes
there
my
you
life. Go. But I'll say that when you leave the project, you have changed somebody's life every single time. Whether it's hopefully for the good, but there's a lot of people that walk away saying, my house is different, but I hope I never have that experience again. I hope I never have that experience again.
Right.
But taking care, it's really good to hear that it's taking care of your people. It's very simple. Like, we have to take care
really
of our
is.
People.
You know, we complain a lot about the lack of workforce, and we know that there's a major shortage in the construction workforce right now. We don't have enough people to build everything that needs to be built right now, and it's not something that we can't outsource it. We can't build it overseas and bring it back here. This is homegrown, and we have to have people on the ground here. And so there is a major labor shortage, and we complain about that. But what do we do about it?
Turn around and treat your people like crap and drive them into the ground.
Exactly.
Pay them less than what they deserve.
I can't get more employees.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
It's a very simple solution. Treat people well and you can attract them to the industry.
Yeah. It's very simple. It's very basic. And why is it so freaking hard for us to do?
I know. Because we've always done it this way. Construction is slow to change.
Yes, it is.
Preach. Yeah. No, yeah. For sure.
What makes you excited about what you do? What do you love about what you do?
What I love about what I do? It's got to be, I hate to say it, but it got to go back to the people. I just love, I love the people. I love, hearing success stories and, I love hearing, how their families have grown, their children have gone out to college or done this or that. And I just know that, WestCor has played a part in their lives.
Yeah.
It just feels amazing. It feels amazing.
Well, I love that. Kevin, then because I'm hearing then you're a people person.
Yes.
That's done. Yeah. Nailed. Yes. Like, I figured you out. You're a people person. It sounds like you're very invested in keeping the right people and having your people be happy. Let's talk about the other side of that. Let's talk about your clients.
Yes.
Because you've scaled the business to a place that is appropriate for where you guys are and where you want to grow. Mm-hmm. Who are your clients? How do you go after them? How do you maintain them? How do you make sure that your clients are paying the right margin so that you keep your people happy?
Sure. Yeah. And that's, one of the strategies that we developed back in the recession is when I said we wanted to get smaller, and we looked around and said, okay, we've got a finite amount of workforce that we have within the company. So today that's 450. So I've got 450 employees. Where am I going to place those employees? They've got to be working on the best jobs with the best margins, which, sounds like a no brainer. Everybody wants to do that, but it's easier said than done.
It's just too easy to say yes at every job when you see a dollar sign at that top line, right?
Yeah, but exactly. So we
figuring out which kind of jobs are you're the best at and can be most profitable at, and sticking to that system.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. We try to do what we do best and do it with the best possible customers and getting to know our customers and trying to create a relationship. It's difficult.
Are they the same customers though, Kevin? Are you selling to the same people?
No, it's changed a lot. It's funny because my assistant was just in my office this morning and we were reviewing a report that I had produced back in 2003. And she said, mm-hmm. I happened to find this, and she was fascinated by it because we looked at that report. And on that report, there was I'm going to say roughly 50 customers. And I bet you only 10 of those 50 are still in business. Yeah. 40 of those 50 are gone now. And of the 10 that are still in business, only two or three that we're still doing business with today. Yeah. To say we've changed a lot over the years and changed our customers. And our customers are constantly changing. And that's why I said about building a relationship is sometimes hard to do with larger customers because they're turnover in personnel. It's much easier to do when we first started the company back in 89 and in the 90s, when we dealt with private companies where I'm dealing directly with the owner of the company. Mm-hmm. And now when you get to these larger publicly traded companies with thousands, tens of thousands of employees, it's a little more difficult to have a relationship there.
Yeah.
With companies.
So who are your clients and how do you go after them? Like, so 50 is a number. Is it 50 clients that you go after every year, 50 projects? How do you keep 450 people busy?
No, we don't have nearly that many customers today. That was 2003. So a lot fewer customers today. Our first priority is to take care of our existing customers. The same philosophy we had with our employees. We said, look, rather than go out and attract new employees, let's take care of our employees first and foremost, and then employees come to us.
Yeah.
And we try to follow the same philosophy with our customers. Let's take care of our existing customers first and foremost. We do good work for them. People will come to us for work. And so we really don't have to do a lot of marketing. You know, people do come to us to bid, and we have to be selective. And that's a tough thing to do.
Ooh.
I've had customers get mad at me when I say, look, I can't bid this project.
I said,
boy, you know, if you're mad now, you're really going to be mad when I get the job and I tell you I can't do it. So let's just rip the Band-Aid off now. And I can't bid it. So we were very selective about bidding. And I know there are plenty of contractors that will bid everything that comes across their desk. And because it's a numbers game. I don't like to play in a numbers game. I'd rather
talk about
more
that.
Selective.
Please talk about that.
Yes. We are just selective about what we're going to bid. It's got to be something that's in our scope that we know very well.
Number one,
it's got to be, you know, a product that we know well. We're not going to venture out into exotic type constructions that is high risk for us. So we're going to stick with what we know. We're going to stick with the customers that we know. As I said, we're going to take care of our existing customers first before we go out and take on new customers. And when it comes to new customers, we're going to vet them pretty well and make sure that they're again, a cultural fit. Like I said, with the employees, you know, we bring on a new employee, they've got to be able to fit with our culture. Our customers have to fit with our culture as well. And they've got to be able to appreciate it.
How do you vet them in that bidding process before you even, you know, started dating? How do you vet your clients?
You know, a lot of it has to do with networking. You know, we're active participants in the Southern Nevada Home Builders Association, which is the Las Vegas chapter of the National Association of Home Builders. We're also active in the Nevada Contractors Association, which is the Las Vegas chapter of the Associated General Contractors. And so, you know, between those organizations, we get out and we get to meet people and talk and you get a good feel for who your customers are when you're meeting them. As you said at the start of this, kind of like we're just hanging out, having a drink at a mixer. You get to know people a lot better than you do, you know, during the day in a typical meeting.
Yeah, fill out this questionnaire, answer the questions.
Exactly. Yeah, the pre-qualification questionnaires. Yeah. That's not going to tell you. But when you're face-to-face, when you're having a cocktail or an appetizer with somebody, you get to know them a lot better.
And after a few cocktails, you know them probably more about them than you probably should. Yeah,
exactly.
But I want to underscore that, Kevin, that it's really important to say no, thank you.
Yes.
When
it's the hardest thing.
It's so hard.
Jim Hammer, especially when you have to go to sleep at night knowing that you have 450 employees that you have to cut a check to every week. Oh, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
Yeah.
I feel like if I'm in that position, I don't know that I ever have enough work. I don't care if I've got a 5-year backlog, right? Like,
right.
That's a lot.
Well, and that's the typical mindset is that we need a ton of backlog. We need a ton of backlog. Yeah.
How do you get clients to wait for you?
To wait for us? You know, ultimately they come around. I don't have a secret recipe for that. I just know that, you know, I told them no, they're mad at me. But I know 6 months from now, there'll be another project and, you know, I do my best to stay in their good graces and we'll get another opportunity to bid again.
Yeah.
So,
well, but that's the thing, right? It's, you're probably better off saying no in a polite way and saying, look, I'm happy to do this for you when we have the time, just can't right now. It doesn't fit, whatever.
Yeah.
Then taking that job, performing poorly, and never getting an opportunity with them ever again, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I hope that they appreciate, you know, the reasons we're not going to bid it. Again, going back to cultural fit, and I think if they get it, then we're a good cultural fit. Because if they don't get it, then maybe we're not a good cultural fit.
Yeah,
yeah. You should understand that. I was just starting to mention that Jim Hammer, who's another founder of the company from Westar Development. I remember Jim Hammer early on in my career in construction saying to me that the best job I ever got was the one I didn't get, kind of a Yogi Berra kind of thing.
Yep.
And so it's good to say no. It's good to say no.
It is good to
say no. So take us back to your transition from CFO to CEO. What was the impetus behind that and kind of roll that into what your responsibilities are on a day-to-day basis today?
Sure. Well, unfortunately, it was under tragic circumstances. So in December of last year, Michael Coronado, our founder and CEO, passed away suddenly.
Oh,
it was completely unexpected. Terrible. Yeah, no known health issues whatsoever. So it was just a sudden thing that happened in December this year. Fortunately, we had spent years in estate planning for him and his family, and in succession planning for the company. So we had a plan in place, which would be some advice I would give to other contractors.
I was going to say, can you say that one more yes. time?
I know a lot of companies that, you know, when the founder or owner is suddenly gone, the company is gone too. So we had put a lot of planning into place to make sure that that we could carry on in the event of his death. But we never planned on actually happening. But it did. But
that's the mental hurdle a lot of people have to get over, right? Like,
yeah,
it's tough to talk about this stuff. But
it's unavoidable. We're all going to die.
Right.
We're all going to die.
Yes.
And that you guys had that, again, that's the kind of thinking that we need to have as business owners. That's our responsibility, quite mm-hmm. frankly, to have a succession plan, because you have 450 people looking to your leadership. Right. And had right. that yeah. not been in place, where would they have gone? I'm sure you right. would figure it out, but it would have been so painful to figure that out on the fly versus. Yeah. So were you always a part of, like, if this were to happen, then I'll step into the CEO role?
Yeah. And that's what we did. You know, right away we began executing the plan that we had in place. We formed a new board of directors right away. Jim Hammer, who again, I mentioned, he was one of the early founders of the company. He had retired from the company in 2012. The other partner, we had originally had three partners. The other partner, Pam Hammer, had sold her interest back in the early 90s. So Michael Coronado was the sole owner of the company at the time of his death. And he had a trust, so the company was held in his trust. And so myself, along with his nephew, were co-trustees of the trust. His nephew is an attorney. I'm an accountant. So we make a pretty good pair of trustees to manage the ownership of the company. Mm-hmm. But Jim Hammer volunteered to come out of retirement. He said, "Is there anything I could do?" And so we asked him to head up our new board of directors. And so he created a board
Culture.
Of directors.
Culture.
And and having that historical perspective, being one of the founders, so just the ability to bring back one of the founders helped a lot to stabilize the operation, and for our employees and our customers to know that you know we had that backbone with Jim here. So he formed that board of directors, brought me on the board. We brought in another contractor, a general contractor here. Agreed to be on the board. We also brought an attorney and an accountant on. So we've got a 5-person board of directors, and we formed that board, and then the board selected the management team. And so the board ultimately made the decision to promote me from CFO to CEO. And then we promoted our controller from her position into the CFO position. Mm-hmm. So that made a fairly smooth transition. I've been here for over 30 years, and, our new CFO has been with us for 17 years. So we've got a lot of history. So it made the transition easy.
Culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Culture. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's really,
so what is your role? Really, what is your role today then? What are you on a day-to-day basis? Where do you find yourself, kind of stepping in?
A lot of customer relations. So that's probably my primary role right now, visiting with customers and assuring them that Westcor is still doing well, and we still have that culture that we talked about, and that it hasn't changed, and that we're carrying that on. So delivering that message to our customers and constantly reassuring them is a primary role of mine. And the same with employees, meeting with employees as well, and reassuring them that our culture is not going to change, and that we're going to stay strong. Everything that the company has built on for all these years is going to continue building and only getting better.
That's really interesting. Well, that's probably a first leg of CEO, that where you're spending the most time is in client relations and employee relations. That's really important. But that absolutely needed to be that to stabilize the shock.
Right. Right. That's my role, the stabilizer, right?
Yeah.
Find yourself almost a year later still kind of in that mindset?
Less of that today. Yeah. So it has been almost a year now. So I less of that. So now my strategy is shifting more to being the visionary, to make sure that I project the vision of the company of where we're going to be 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to build that long-term vision and make sure our customers and employees and vendors all know what that vision is.
Yeah.
I'm also working with the Coronado family. So the trust, as I mentioned earlier, trust owns the company, but it's for the benefit of the Coronado family. And, hopefully I would like to see members of that family come into the business down the road and 10, yeah. 20 years from now, I would love to have the next generation. So as I said, with Michael, we spent years doing estate planning for him and succession planning for the company. Now that we've executed that, we have to set up the next plan of transition to make sure that this, I'd love for this to be a 100-year-old company. So we're thinking 100 years. Down the road. So that's my goal right now.
You mentioned kind of vision being your mindset right now. What does that vision look like 3, 5, 10 years down the road right now?
Good question.
Yeah. 10 years from down the road, I'd like to, at that point, have one of Michael's children, or at least one or two in the company and working towards grooming them to be the next CEO would be my ultimate goal. I'd love to have them in management and be ready to have a smooth transition, just like we did with this time, into that next generation of Coronado family members here in the company.
Do you
and
see
from
yourself?
An operations,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. From an operations standpoint, kind of similar to where you're at now, both geographically and scope of work and all those things.
Yeah, I think we might tiptoe into. So that's a really good question. Looking long term, I do want to look at the other market areas that we used to be in. So Arizona, Southern California, Utah. We do want to cautiously consider working our way into those territories, but do it in a much more restrained mode than we did the last time. Yeah. Controlled means. Okay. Exactly. So that is a really good question. I think I could see us 10 years down the road being in those other market areas. I do see us back out there again.
Do you think that might be a little easier in 2023, call it 24, with technology being the way it is and the unfortunate COVID shift of, being able to move everything kind of online and being virtual? Because back in the 80s, 90s, when you guys started and got in early 2000s, when you got into Arizona and California and Utah, like you said, you had to bring on debt to kind of open up a hub there, right?
Whereas,
do you think that might be a little easier now, given the technology advancements and the comfortability with technology inside construction, to be able to kind of go into those places without fully committing and getting into a debt position?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a really good point. We don't need that physical infrastructure to enter into a new market anymore like it used to. Mm-hmm. So remote work has done a lot. And so from a organizational standpoint, we can maintain all of our administrative functions here in our central office and not have to establish these remote offices. So that definitely simplifies things. All we need to do is have our field operations set up in those remote areas. So it'll definitely make it a lot easier to expand regionally. Yeah,
for sure.
Kevin, talking about vision, what are the things about the industry when you're thinking about your company plans is one thing. And when we go into the industry, what makes you excited about the industry and what makes you nervous? What worries you?
It might be the same answer for both, but technology. technology. The construction industry.
Why does it worry you?
Well, for one thing, the construction industry is historically lagged behind all other industries when it comes to investment technology. We're a carpentry company. We still use hammers and nails.
Yeah.
The same. We've been doing that for 2,000 years.
Yeah, Jesus Christ himself used it.
Yes. We have nail guns. We have some technology, but I'm talking about real technology. I'm talking about robotics and things like that, prefabrication. It's been tried, and that's what makes me nervous, is that we there have been investments in that area, and they failed time and time again.
Yeah.
So, I see a huge need for an investment in technology, because again, I mentioned earlier about we don't have enough people to build the stuff we need to build.
Yeah.
Congress passing the infrastructure bill and all the billions of dollars being put into infrastructure. That's great, but we still need people to build this stuff.
That's where I was like, that's so exciting that all this business is coming into our industry. We have no one to do it.
Nobody to do it. Nobody to do it. So we've got to build more with less. We got to build more product with less people. How do we do that? And so there, you do that by improving efficiency, and you can improve efficiency through technology is how most industries have done it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You look at the auto industry.
Kind of doesn't like that answer. In most cases, though.
And I don't know if it's the industry doesn't like it. It's just we just haven't found the right mousetrap to make it work. Right. We got to figure it out. But that's why I say I'm most excited about that, but I'm also most nervous about that because I know it's the answer that the industry needs. We need more investment in technology. And maybe if we do, we've just got that. I think that's probably the underlying problem is that we haven't pumped enough money into it to really make it work.
Yeah. Well, I feel like a lot of the industry hasn't just committed 100% to it, right? It's kind of been a little tiptoe, like, yeah, maybe. No. Never mind.
Yeah.
Kind of scary, right?
It's,
you need a good portion of the industry to just dive in and commit to it.
Yeah.
And before it does it. But I mean, we're 50 minutes later now. And now going to that very first question I had, that it was obviously way too early in our conversation, but how do you stick around for almost 30 years as a stick framer when almost everything is trying to push to offsite prefab,
right?
You know, deliver it, put it up in a day, framing.
Nailed it, Mike. Appropriate timing. You nailed it, brother. Good
no
job.
No pun intended.
Yeah, lot better than 3 minutes in the conversation. Huh?
A lot better than that. Now I have some context.
Well, I will say that prefabrication, panelization is something that we're keeping a close eye on. And here at Westcor, we're ready to move into that market. That is something that we need to keep on our vision board for down the road, for 10 years down the road. That is something we very well may be into ourselves.
Yeah.
And we have tried it. As you said earlier, Mike,
you have to imagine some prefabrication. You have to, right? Like,
yeah. So we
just
do
to
some,
see how good you can be at it and what it would take, and
we build panels in our yard right now. Yeah. And, when we're building a home, any piece of the home that involves a header where you've got a window or a door, we'll frame those sections in our yard here and then ship them to the job site. So we have dabbled into that, and we're prepared to get into it more. But right now, our customers. Are the key. Our customers are not wanting that at this point. But again, back to what I said about technology, that what you talked about, the panelization, the prefab and all that, that is another part of the solution to our labor shortage about, the ability to build more with less. We're going to have to be more of a factory. We got to take a look at the auto industry and look at what they do to crank out a vehicle. We're going to have to mass produce, components of construction. And that really is, and that's going to take technology to do that. That's where I mentioned robotics. Robotics is a possibility. You have to look at robotics to help build portions and get them shipped to the job site so that we can, build these buildings with fewer actual employees on the job site.
Yeah. This is next level thinking. This is very outer space-ish thinking. We need to be talking about if construction is ever going to catch up.
And that's key. We've got to think that way, and we don't. We still earlier I mentioned about construction, we're slow to change. We keep doing things the way we've always done it because we've always done it that way, but we've got to break out of that mold and find more innovations in order to improve efficiencies on job sites to be able to build more with less.
Listen, Kevin, I'll tell you what, the more females that come into this business, the quicker that'll happen.
Yes, absolutely. You're
welcome.
Absolutely. That's another big thing I complain about. We talk about the shortage of employees in the industry, but when you look at the demographics of our industry, we've barely tapped into women in construction. We need a lot more.
50-50, you got about 48% more employees out there, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, we can really do some good damage more we commit. Go ahead.
Yeah. So we're going to get into rapid fire towards the end of this thing. Marcelo's got some rapid fire questions that we like to ask everybody. But one kind of fun question that I don't know if you're going to have the answers for be off the top of the head, but linear feet. Do you guys track linear feet and how much you guys install on a weekly or monthly basis? I just want to know the numbers.
We track square footage, and you're going to stump me on that, so I can't tell you. But,
okay.
But
no
square footage on our
I
framing.
I have to imagine the linear free from a framing standpoint of 2x4 is probably.
Yeah. And we probably have that number somewhere as far as board footage that used, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. And I'm a numbers guy, so this is really embarrassing.
Gotcha.
No, you're a financial number guy. That's an operations number. It's okay. Okay.
Mike, sometimes Mike, sometimes you really impress me with your questions. I would have never, where do you come up with that?
It's just something I think about because I think it's fun.
You think about linear feet. Oh my God.
Well, that would be a good one if I had the answer. That was a great question.
And here's why. Here's why, right? So we talk about prefabrication construction, right? So way back in my original iteration of this podcast, I had a guy on, Jerry. I don't remember his name. He's Irish guy. He's funny than hell. But he is a CEO of a company called Integra, which is out of Fresno. And that's all they do. They're a giant warehouse and they prefab.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
And so what they manage their production based on board feet. That's how they know how much or how efficient their production is or what kind of week or day that they have ahead of them is board feet production. So I was just kind of curious. And I don't know what his number is, so I wasn't trying to compare you. I was just kind of curious because I know that
they're light years ahead of us. They're the innovators that I was talking about that we need in this industry.
Yeah, but like you said, there's not many builders that are of that mindset yet, right?
Yeah,
so I mean,
not yet.
It takes the industry kind of diving in. But
okay.
I digress.
Very sassy question. That's not a sassy. That's like a thinker question. I see you leveling up all your game. I'm going to have to do some reading to level up my game with you, Mike. All right. So, Kevin.
I'm not just an insurance nerd.
You're so much more. You are so much more than an insurance nerd.
All right. Let's get into it.
As Mike said, as we've talked about, we really want this podcast to be a resource for people. And for the guests that we get to talk to, we just want to draw outside of the conversation. What are some of the things that you're doing that maybe someone can be like, I want to try that. I love listening to podcasts that I walk out better from. Mm-hmm. So there are four simple questions. First question, what's the one resource your business cannot do without?
Oh boy. Probably insurance, I would say. We rely a lot on our broker. Provides us with a lot of advice.
Mike.
Risk management.
Mike.
We did it.
We're waiting for you. I'm so excited. Somebody said an insurance guy.
Yes.
Oh, man.
But risk management is so important in construction because we're surrounded by risk in this industry. And so risk management's key.
Yes. Look, for anyone hearing that, that might not be sexy, but it's so true. Like you have to have a guy on your side who's in your corner. Mike is my guy. He's the guy that I don't know what the hell this means, that I can text him. I can call him. I can email him. Yes. We have that relationship and there's no stupid question with Mike.
Right.
And so having that resource is everything. So I have learned the hard way. It's not just about the number.
Blush.
It's not just about the number. I'm giving you your 2 minutes.
I know you're giving me your 2 minutes. I'm not even understand.
It's not just about the number. And as a leader and as a business owner, once you can get out of what is the bottom number, what is the bottom line, and start thinking about who is in my corner, it will change. It will change your business, and you'll be better for
it.
All right.
Absolutely.
Number two, what's the best advice someone has given you that you still use today?
That probably going back to what Jim Hammer said about the best job I ever got was the one I didn't get. And that is just the, ability to say no.
The ability to say no. I would echo that. Number three, is there a book or a podcast that you love, that you recommend?
I just finished reading. I recommend a lot is a book called Traction.
Do you know who the
Traction
author is?
Traction. I don't know the Gino Wickman, I believe is the author. The book's called Traction. It talks about EOS, which is the Entrepreneurial Operating System, which is a great way to organize your business. And so I would recommend that to all business owners, Traction.
Traction. I'm looking it up on Amazon today.
It's about how to gain traction in your business.
Okay.
Gino Wickman.
Gina Wickman. Yeah.
Gina Wickman.
Yep.
All right. And Kevin, you're a lot of things. Like you are a new CEO. You're in your infancy stage of your CEO.
Yes.
And so you have a lot of responsibilities. You have 450 mouths to feed plus. What is one habit that you have for yourself? How do you pour into yourself so that you can pour into others? What's one thing you do that is just for you?
I take care of myself. So I exercise regularly. It really clears my mind. Actually, I'm training for an Ironman triathlon for next year. So,
people
at the ripe age of 60. So
I was going to say, I didn't want to put you on blast, but I was just going to say for the people not watching the video, he's not like 22 years old.
No, like, I'm not a kid. I'm 60.
I wasn't going to put your age out there or kind of try and guess, but for people listening, he's not 22.
Kevin is about to do
an Ironman.
Kevin is a CEO. He has 450 employees. He's a new CEO, and you're training for an Ironman. Dude,
that's awesome.
There's no excuses. That's incredible. Yeah. Good for you.
I do some of my best, critical thinking when I'm, running or riding a bike.
Not so much
when I'm swimming.
Are you a morning guy or are you an evening guy?
I'm an evening guy. I tried to do mornings, but it's just, construction is early already.
Yeah. Well, it gets too damn hot to train at 2 a.m.
Yeah. So that's a good point, Mike. How are you training the evening in the summers? Yeah. Like what?
A treadmill. I have to run on a treadmill. Indoor. Yeah, I got to do it indoors. Yeah, I just can't. I do it indoors. Biking, I still do outdoors, but the running is really difficult in the heat.
You play golf
at all,
Kevin?
Not nearly enough. Again, it's a matter of time. I wish I had more time to play more golf, but I do occasionally.
Kevin, will you do Mike and I a favor? When you, after Ironman, will you send us a photo?
You got
of
it.
You
of course.
Finishing?
Yeah. Of course.
That
of
would
course
be really cool.
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
When is it going to be?
It's May of 2023. I don't know the exact dates, but May in St. George, Utah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Please do that. Thank you for spending time with us, Kevin. Thank you for teaching
us.
Yeah, Kevin's been rad.
Your stories. This is really cool. Thank you, Kevin. Yeah.
Good luck to you. Spending the time with you. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Kevin.
Real quick, before we go, give everybody your shout outs. How do they get a hold of you? How do they find you? How do they look you guys up?
Website, Instagram, what do you got?
Sure, yeah. Our website is westcorecompanies.com. That's WESTCOR companies.com is our website. You can find me on LinkedIn, Kevin Booth, CCIFP, because I'm a certified construction industry financial professional.
So okay.
That's my credentials on the end of my name there. But if you look up, there's a lot of Kevin Booths, but there's only one Kevin Booth CCIFP out there.
perfect.
But you can find me on LinkedIn, Facebook, and look us up there.
All right.
Awesome.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks again, Kevin. It's been great. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you had a good time, be sure to hit that subscribe button to get all the latest episodes. And if you had a really good time, leave a review to let us know what you thought. Until then, go gather some crazy stories on your job sites, and we'll see you next time on So, You Want to Be a Contractor.